From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we go into the wild as Animal Week continues. Documentary filmmakers Beverly and Derek Joubert have devoted their lives to filming Africa's disappearing wildlife. They'll tell us about their adventures tracking wild elephants. Jane Goodall will look back on her experiences studying wild chimpanzees in Tanzania. Witnessing a chimp war and being attacked by a chimp reminded her not to sentimentalize the animals. And environmentalist Doug Peacock will tell us about the times he was charged by grizzly bears. For 3 decades, he's been tracking and studying grizzlies in the mountains of the West. Animal Week continues, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The House Republicans who will manage the trial of President Clinton in the Senate met to meet today for the first time since the House impeachment vote was cast. NPR's Brian Naylor has more.
The managers are led by Judiciary Committee Chairman Henry Hyde and include 12 other Republicans from the panel. They will act as the prosecuting attorneys in the trial. In today's meeting, the managers will try to come up with a strategy for the trial, including whether to call witnesses. In the House impeachment proceedings, lawmakers relied on sworn grand jury testimony from some of the key figures, such as Monica Lewinsky and Presidential Secretary Betty Curry. Hyde is reportedly considering calling Lewinsky to appear before the Senate, even though many senators say such testimony is unnecessary. The House managers are also expected to review the Senate rules in today's session and divvy up responsibilities for conducting just the second presidential impeachment trial in history. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
Iraq's vice president says Iraqi warplanes will operate in the no-fly zones over the country in defiance of the patrols by U.S. and British aircraft. The announcement comes a day after American fighter jets retaliated for surface-to-air missile firings by the Iraqis by destroying an anti-aircraft battery. The United States and its Persian Gulf War allies set up the no-fly zones in northern and southern Iraq after the Gulf War to protect Kurdish rebels and Shiite Muslims from Saddam Hussein's forces. 3 Britons and an American were killed when troops in Yemen today stormed a hideout where the tourists were being held hostage. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
The 3 tourists were killed during a gunfight between Yemeni security forces and the kidnappers. According to the Yemeni embassy in London, 2 of the kidnappers also died in the shootout. The tourists were among a group of 16 people abducted yesterday, not far from the port of Aden. Initial reports said that a group of local tribesmen were responsible. Kidnapping is not uncommon in Yemen. There have been several dozen this year. Usually the kidnappers are seeking concessions from the government about public services, such as improved roads and schools, before releasing their hostages. Previous tourist abductions have ended peacefully. But reports claim that the group responsible for yesterday's abductions was an Islamic militant organization demanding the release of its leader, arrested 2 weeks ago in a government crackdown on Islamic extremists. Michael Goldfarb, NPR News, London.
President Clinton is taking new steps to combat violence against children. Under the initiative, the Justice Department will propose legislation that would make it easier for federal prosecutors to prove a felony murder charge involving the death of a child without having to prove that the death was premeditated. Mr. Clinton cited research which shows that children who experience serious violence are 50% more likely to be arrested as juveniles and nearly 40% more likely to be arrested as adults. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is now in positive territory, up 66 points. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, after 7 straight up days, some bouncing around on Wall Street and fairly light trading today ahead of the New Year's holiday, NPR's Jack Spear joins us with the latest.
With investors taking some of their profits from the recent run-up, especially in the seemingly too-hot-to-cool-down technology sector today, the market opened slightly lower. However, just before the noon hour, stocks are higher. Blue-chip stocks turned upwards. The Nasdaq is barely lower. The market took some heart from a conference board report today that said consumer confidence was pretty much unchanged in December after a slightly bigger bump up the month before. That was viewed as positive since spending by consumers accounts for 2/3 of the nation's overall economic activity. The National Association of Realtors also reported today a bigger-than-expected rise in sales of existing homes. In November, sales of previously owned homes were up by 2.7%. That was mostly attributed to continued low mortgage interest rates. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Conoco plans to take a charge in the current quarter of $50 million as the result of a corporate realignment. The company says it's also planning to trim fewer than 1,000 jobs worldwide. The moves stem in part from low crude oil prices that are forecast to continue through next year. Shares of Value Vision Incorporated are up more than 100% today. The company says its pre-Christmas sales on its television home shopping business grew more than 50% over the same period 1 year ago. The Internal Revenue Service has announced that it's delaying the planned reduction in the reimbursement rate for business driving after several companies asked for more time to convert their computer software. The reduction from the current rate of 32.5 cents a mile down to 31 cents has been delayed now until April 1st. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross with day two of our Animal Week. Today we go into the wild. Filmmakers Derek and Beverly Joubert shoot scenes most of us will never get to see firsthand, like hyenas feasting on a zebra and elephants mating. In 1995, the Jouberts won a Peabody Award for their National Geographic special, Reflections on Elephants. It followed some of the last free-roaming African elephants in northern Botswana. Reflections on Elephants was the Jouberts' sixth National Geographic special. They're currently in L.A. working on a feature film about elephants. The Jouberts, who are married, live in the bush most of the year, tracking animals in their customized jeep. They grew up in South Africa and met in high school. I spoke with them in 1994, just before the broadcast of Reflections on Elephants. Their film has a rare scene of an elephant dying. This was an old elephant the Jouberts had been tracking for several months. They'd first seen this elephant in 1981. I asked them to describe the death.
First of all, it was an intensely dry time, so he was desperate for water. There wasn't a lot of grazing around as well. So what they had to do, all the bulls, is leave the area and go and graze and then walk at least 2 to 3 kilometers or more back to the water. And there's very little water around. So most of the healthy bulls had really dominated the water area and he couldn't get to it. And he stood around through the heat of the day and into the night for hours waiting to get to water. And eventually he braved it and he went in. And once he started to drink, one of the more dominant bulls actually jostled with him and moved him off. And he still didn't move. And of course, he eventually got a tusk right into the side of his neck. And he dropped down and bled to death. He was just so weak that he just couldn't get up and he died there.
Why would an elephant gore a member of its own herd?
Well, I don't think he intentionally meant to gore him, obviously not even knowing the weakness that that bull was in. But that is the way that they perform around water that is so little at the time. And the more dominant bull would drink first and then move off, and then the second one in charge would drink, and that's the way it would go. And if somebody steps out of line, the bull that would be drinking that is in charge will definitely just try and put that one bull back into line. And that's what happened. I think it was more an accidental death.
How did the elephants respond when this one elephant was dying?
It was stunning, actually. We didn't even realize what we were going to witness, but we moved in there for about 8 days and eight nights to follow the complete cycle of this death and the carcass. The other bulls spent a lot of time around that carcass. They would go up to it and they'd smell it and they would investigate the carcass all the time, paying particular attention to the ivory, I might add. But there were some really eerie moments where, in particularly in the early afternoon, about 4 in the afternoon, the bulls would all gather around this carcass and simply stand there for 15 or 20 minutes, not doing anything, not even smelling it. And then they'd all disperse again. So it was a very moving and touching time, I think.
How long did it take after the elephant died for the hyenas to come and start feeding on the corpse?
It was actually very quick because they actually heard the death screams of this elephant. And they were also in the vicinity at the time because obviously they wanted water as well. So I would say it was almost 20 minutes at the most, and they were there. They didn't start feeding straight away because the bulls wouldn't allow them to feed. First of all the other elephants came in, and they started, first of all, trying to pick the carcass up. And some of the bulls, that the younger bulls, all of a sudden started doing a mock mating display on the bull that had died on the carcass. And shortly after, once the bulls had left the carcass, did the hyenas come in. But then the bulls constantly would come in and chase the hyenas periodically through the night.
How many days does it take for the elephant corpse to be consumed?
This one was remarkably quick. It was 8 days and 8 nights.
Are there any leftover parts? What happens to the ivory?
Mm-hmm. Well, the bones get scattered for a start. Hyenas, you know, run off with bits and pieces of bones. And what happened in this particular case is that the ivory was pulled on the day by an elephant and then dropped in the mud and then stood on by other elephants and then disappeared. And then some months later, an elephant worked away at a piece of ivory with his trunk and then extracted this whole tusk, walked around with it, and that's a really haunting and eerie moment.
It extracted the tusk from?
From the mud.
It had buried it?
Yeah, where it had landed, I think, accidentally. It wasn't a conscious burying of this thing, but it landed there and the mud hole dried up. But one bull eventually extracted it and then walked around with it, displayed it, and stood on it, tried to break it. We've seen this quite a lot. We've often seen elephants wander off with tusks and smash them against trees and break them against rocks and things like that.
What for?
Who knows? It's really a difficult thing to try and interpret without being too anthropomorphic. But so much of elephant behavior is focused around the mouth. So when they greet, they put a trunk into the other one's mouth, and that's the way they smell who the other one is and where they've been, what feeding's out there. And so there's so much attention paid to the mouth and the tusk area. This may be an extension of that.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Derek and Beverly Joubert, and they make films about animals in the south of Africa. They have a National Geographic special filmed in Botswana called Reflections on Elephants. An earlier film that you made was about lions and hyenas. It was called Eternal Enemies. And you filmed them at night. I wonder if you ever felt that you were in danger watching animals fight with each other and eat each other.
No, never, ever. We're very, very comfortable, in particular at night, because we've just spent so much time out there with lions and hyenas and elephants at night. I think that in particular when animals are busy killing each other or fighting or whatever they're doing, when they're active, they're so involved in their own lives that they totally ignore us. And the way that we've developed our relationship with them is to be totally inobtrusive. So we've really worked on trying to not influence us and try to just be invisible as much as possible.
Do you try to slowly condition the animals to your presence?
Yes, we do. When we're working with elephants, it's a slow approach that you have to do, usually from slightly behind so that they don't feel threatened. And the minute you see a reaction, then you start backing off or you head the other way or maybe just freeze. With animals at night, it's much more complex. We've worked sometimes with lions and hyenas for 6 weeks before we've been able to use our filming lights on them and film effectively.
Because they are more annoyed by the lights than by your presence?
Well, lights are a new thing to them. And so what we try to do is make sure that they thought of it as just something that was there, like another moon possibly. And the same thing with elephants. When we've got some night scenes in this new film of elephants, but they're mainly around waterholes. And the way that we did that is we would set up lights at the waterholes and just leave them there, go away for a couple of days at a time and allow the animals to approach the lighted area and go into it and feel comfortable there.
Has your reaction changed over the years to watching animals feeding on each other and attacking each other? Were you disturbed by it initially and then got used to it? Or, you know, was there any kind of emotional difference to your response?
Definitely disturbed in the beginning. I remember the first kill that I watched. It was a desperately sad one because it was so gruesome. And it was between first of all, they tried to bring down a baby zebra, and then the lions lost it to hyenas, and this baby zebra stood up again, and it was all mauled. And then, of course, they had another fight, and the lions took it over, and that's the way it carried on. And for at least a half an hour, this baby zebra hadn't been killed yet. It was still living, but yet very badly mauled. And that was desperately disturbing. And from then on, I think all the other kills were a lot easier to watch. There are times, though, when I think the time that I really get emotionally involved is when we get to know an animal before something terrible happens to it, and that is the worst.
But you wouldn't dream of intervening?
No, we do have a policy that we're out there to document, and if man is not interfering in any way, we're not going to interfere at all. If, for example, we came across an animal that had been badly snared, we would try and intervene, but we would never intervene in nature.
You know, I think there's two instincts that that your average person would have if they saw an animal killing another animal. One is fear that when this animal's done killing the other animal, the animal's going to turn and kill you. And the other is, you know, oh, I must stop this. You know, this is something gruesome and violent and destructive that's happening. But you're able to not act on those instincts, or maybe they're not even instincts for you anymore.
No, they're not, and you have to be logical about it. And first of all, this behavior has been going on for millions, tens of millions of years. So the one little impala that you're going to save is going to make no difference at all. And it seems futile to do that. The other thing is that while you're saving that one, in the darkness, about a half a kilometer away, it's happening again. So, you know, it's just so futile, and it doesn't make any sense at all. The other thing, of course, is that while on the face of things, it may look like you're being kind to save a young zebra from being eaten by a pride of lions, those lions have cubs somewhere that need to be fed as well. And so the minute you start intervening, you start unraveling this whole tapestry, and it all falls apart in your hands.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, you know, we're out there without any firearms, without any protection at all. And when hyenas or lions have already decided that they are going to try and kill whatever it is, the blood is up. For Derek and I to jump out and to try and protect whatever it is would be futile, and we would probably get a little hurt ourselves, or we could be the next prey.
My guests are filmmakers Beverly and Derek Joubert. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Beverly and Derek Joubert, filmmakers who are documenting disappearing wildlife in Africa. Have you ever been attacked by an animal?
We have been attacked by an elephant cow. She was protecting her young. It was unknown to us that she or the little calf was even in the area, and she came out of the bushes charging and hit us. And she picked us up, and she rocked the vehicle a lot, and while she was hitting us, chips of her ivory were flying into the vehicle. We eventually managed to get her to leave us. It was at night time, and Derek shone the lights in her eyes, and she eventually left us. We were unharmed, and so was she, and luckily the calf was unharmed totally as well, and the two of them went off together.
Were you afraid?
At the time, I know, I was shaking like a leaf, and obviously the adrenaline was flowing. So I guess I was definitely afraid. But we have been hit by an elephant since then. And I think living through that experience has helped me realize that if you know your subject, you definitely can get out of a situation.
Well, but how exactly did you get out of it? How did you use your knowledge to protect yourself?
Oh, well, the first thing, of course, is we knew that a strange elephant from nowhere wouldn't like to have a strong spotlight shone in her eyes. And so while she was busy bashing this out of the vehicle, instead of jumping forward and trying to hit her with something, which would have been a bit crazy anyway, because the biggest thing that we have is a big screwdriver, I've managed to find the spotlight and shone that directly in her eyes. And so she turned away and covered her eyes with her ears and moved away from the vehicle. And then immediately, strangely, I felt as I didn't want to disturb her too much. So I switched the light off. And, of course, she turned and ran back and bashed us around a bit more. But then when the light went on the second time, she moved off and I kept it on for a while.
And did you try the same thing the second time you were attacked?
No, the second time around it was during the day, and so we couldn't use that weapon of light. The second time around it was an elephant that we think had been shot by a poacher, because she had a wound that we found afterwards. But she just came out of the water and gave us almost no warning at all and just ran straight for us and smashed into the front of the vehicle. There was nothing we could do then except... actually, what I did do then was... As she was about to hit, I took the vehicle out of gear so that there wouldn't be a huge amount of resistance. And she hit and she pushed us down this little track that we were on for about 100 yards or so. And then I put the brakes on and then she felt the resistance and that was enough for her to feel uncomfortable and she moved off.
Do you ever run into situations where there's a competing filmmaker trying to study the same herd that you are?
We have not. It has happened, and it's a very uncomfortable thing. We've kind of selected areas that are just so mean and miserable and tetsy fly ridden that nobody else wants to work there.
Well, how do you deal with the misery of the, of the area you're surrounded yourself with, like the insects, which, by the way, can cause terrible illness?
Yes, they can. Well, there's normally a precaution. I mean, for mosquitoes, there's a precaution and you can sleep on a mosquito net and, you know, that can help. When we're working at nighttime with the lights, actually, that is the worst because that attracts every single insect that is around. And they're insects that actually give out formaldehyde. They're called blister beetles. And what happens there is they put a formaldehyde onto your body and huge blisters form on your body. And then, of course, the tsetse flies are... I got a nasty burn, and luckily, because we're not in areas where we're close to villages, the tsetse flies do not carry sleeping sickness. So we're fortunate in that way, that if you stay away from other communities, you normally will be safe, that you're not going to get the illness.
Boy, you know, I'm just thinking about what it's like when you have a porch light shining in the summer in the United States, and the insects from all the neighborhoods come to your porch light and just swarm around. It must be incredible in Africa when you're working at night with the lights.
It is, especially when I'm holding the lights. I mean, my whole body is just covered. It's like my body's black with insects. But I can't move because Derek is filming and we can't move the vehicle because, you know, that's almost his tripod.
So what kind of protective clothing are you wearing?
No protective clothing at all. But I'm not wriggling around or squashing them or anything like that, so normally I'm fine.
One of the problems is that even though it's nighttime out there in the insect season, it's very, very hot. And so we're using just the barest minimum of clothing, so we don't have a lot of protection from these bugs.
Now, Beverly, these films are really worth it to you to subject yourself to being covered from head to foot with insects while you film.
These films are our babies, so we'll go through everything.
Apparently you will go through everything. Do you think that you've been changed by living around animals and away from people?
I know I have. I think that every time we come into town, it takes us quite a lot of time to readjust when we go back. Find that we become much more intense. We become faster. We're not as thoughtful as we are when we're out in the bush. I think being around animals gives you a far better grasp on life and on death and makes you a calmer, more peaceful person.
Beverly, what would you say?
I agree with all of that. There are times that when we first arrive in the cities that I'm very uncomfortable around people because obviously I'm not used to all the social activities and there are times that I might be... too abrupt because I believe that honesty is the best policy and often you really have to be a lot more subtle. But that is what happens when you're out in the bush. You actually do feel that it's pointless playing social games. You know, you're out there and it's really a matter of survival often. And you respect people, I think, a lot more when you're living out in the bush.
You know, I'm thinking that what one does to protect oneself is really different, say, in the city than it is in the wild. In the wild, I imagine you try to be inobtrusive, to move very slowly so as to not startle an animal, to be as unthreatening as possible. Whereas in the city, sometimes you really want to look threatening so that people don't bother you, you know, so that you look very kind of tough and sure of yourself. And, you know, you should have a kind of jaunty, assertive step when you walk through the street. It's in a way exactly the opposite of what you need to do in the wild.
That's right. In fact, you guys need guns here. We don't need guns at all. You're right. Walking in the bush, you need to be really quiet and walk slowly. And it's quite funny when people come out to us, we go out for a walk and they start striding out there, really covering distance, moving fast and swinging their arms and that sort of thing. And you don't want to do that. You know, you walk very, very slowly. I find that people in New York, for instance, walk at twice the pace that I do. And you tend to melt in a little easier. For instance, if a lion charges, what you do is you don't jump up and down and assert yourself. You stand your ground and you're quiet, but confident. And if you did, and if you started running around and waving your arms, then the lion would jump on you.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Mm. Thank you very much, Terry.
Thank you. Yeah, it was fun.
Derek and Beverly Joubert, recorded in 1994, just before the broadcast of their film Reflections on Elephants. They're now at work on a feature film about elephants. The Jouberts will be featured on the National Geographic Explorers series this January in an episode called Wild Passions, a behind-the-scenes look at wildlife filmmakers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up as Animal Week continues, Jane Goodall talks about our closest genetic relative, the chimpanzee, and Doug Peacock tells us about his close encounters with grizzlies and why he now tries to save them. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Next on this Animal Week edition, we're going to hear from the two most celebrated women who have worked with primates, Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey. They both loved the animals they studied and learned to vocalize like them. Diane Fossey spent close to 20 years in Central Africa studying the nearly extinct mountain gorilla. She was murdered in 1985. In 1982, she told me about the connection she felt to the gorillas.
When I look at a gorilla, I feel like I'm looking at the better half of myself. There's a gentle, regal, magnificent air about a gorilla that I have not seen in any other animal as yet. And, of course, when I went to the field at first in 1963 and saw my first free-living gorilla, I felt a very strong emotional attachment, and I knew that I'd have to go back and study them. I wanted to communicate with the gorillas, so it was essential that I learn their means of communication. So then I learned that I had to imitate their contentment vocalizations, and the most common of these is what I have termed the belch vocalization, and that's a very soothing mwah, 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 mwah. And I could see that this was really the ticket to my entry into gorilla land, so I've been belching ever since. And I'm afraid I've taken to liking it so much that even in society, if I'm stumped to the answer of a question or if I disagree mildly with something, instead of giving a retort, I just go, mwah. It'd be a wonderful world if all of us went around doing that when we were going to have a squabble with someone.
Diane Fossey recorded in 1982. The animal that most closely resembles humans genetically is the chimpanzee. Perhaps that explains our fascination with chimps. In 1960, Jane Goodall began the first long-term study of wild chimpanzees at Gombe National Park in Tanzania. Goodall is widely acknowledged as the world's leading expert on wild chimps. Now she spends most of her time traveling, lecturing on her experiences in the field, and speaking on behalf of saving wild chimps. When I spoke with Goodall in 1993, she had just co-authored a book about the relationship between humans and chimpanzees. I asked if she learned chimp vocalizations and if she used them to communicate with chimps.
I can make most of them. Most of the people studying chimps can make those sounds, but we don't actually make them in the wild. I sometimes make them to chimps in captive groups, and they usually reply. Certainly that the little greeting sound, when you want to approach a nervous young chimp, which I have to do all the time, because one of the things that we're doing with the Institute is to rescue orphan chimps whose mothers have been shot by hunters. They're confiscated by the government and we care for them. And to see some of those pathetic little orphans in the markets being sold at the street side, they're dehydrated, their eyes are dull, they're losing hope, they're losing health. And you go up and you make this soft little which is a gentle greeting, and they'll sometimes put their arm around your neck.
How come you wouldn't use that language in the wild?
Because we've always tried to be as unobtrusive as possible, to keep in the background, to let the chimpanzees get on with their lives, not to try and communicate with them, but to be part of the environment that they will ignore, and they can get on with their lives.
What else would you say to a chimp in captivity?
Well, I sometimes make the distance call, which chimpanzees at Gombe make when they're calling out from one side of a valley to the other, and they're basically identifying themselves, or perhaps questioning, who's over there, I'm here.
Is that a sound you could demonstrate for us?
Well, I can demonstrate it, but I just lean away from the microphone because it's rather loud, but
how did you learn to do that? I mean, did you practice in the wild away from the chimps?
Well, I practiced away from the chimps.
So I imagine a lot of the researchers like practice this on each other, huh?
Yeah, well, sometimes if I'm giving a lecture and there's some of my students in the audience, I explain beforehand, you know, that I'm going to make this call and they're going to reply, and that always brings the house down.
In all your years in the field studying chimpanzees, were there particular aspects of chimp behavior that you felt you understood and were particularly like your own, particularly like the way humans behave?
Oh, I think a lot. One of the most striking, really, is the non-verbal communication patterns, so that the chimpanzees will kiss, embrace, hold hands, pat one another on the back, swagger, threaten by shaking their fists, tickle. And the striking thing here is that not only do the patterns look like so many of ours, but they're used in the same context, so they obviously mean the same kind of thing.
When you got to Tanzania and you knew you were there to watch and research the chimps, were they easy to find?
No, they used to run away. The first moment they saw me, they would depart into the undergrowth. And it was very frustrating. But gradually, from an open rocky peak overlooking two valleys, one on the north, one on the south, using my binoculars, wearing the same colored clothes every day, they got used to this queer white-skinned ape who'd appeared so surprisingly in their midst. And so gradually I was able to get closer and closer and learn ever more about their fascinating behavior.
One chimp was particularly helpful to you because he was the first chimp that befriended you, shall we say. What did he do to help introduce you to the others?
He was fantastic. That was David Greybeard. And I probably owe more to him than any other chimp throughout these long 33 years. For some reason, he had a particularly calm and trusting disposition. Of course, every chimpanzee has his or her own totally individual personality, just like we do. And David, instead of running off, would just sit and calmly continue what he was doing. It was David who one day arrived in my camp to feed on the ripe fruits of the oil nut palm growing there. And while he was there, he saw some bananas lying on the table and he took those. My cook told me about this male chimp who'd arrived, and eventually I stayed down and waited to see who it was, and then that's how I found out it was David Greybeard. I'd already named him from my encounters in the forest. And from that time on, he would sometimes wander up to me in the forest to see if I had a banana somewhere hidden about my person or in my haversack. And the other chimps would start to run, and then they'd stop, and their eyes were big and wide, and they'd think, what is this? What is going on? And so they realized that I wasn't so frightening after all. And it was as though David had opened a door into what was then a really magic unknown world.
What were the signs that you were being accepted by the other chimps?
They didn't run away. They stayed when I could approach, and they would look up, and then they'd continue their grooming or their playing or their feeding or whatever it was they were doing before I came.
Would they approach you and make friendly gestures toward you?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. They just continued with what they were doing.
Did it ever get to that point as time went on where chimps would come up to you and be friendly in a conscious way?
Well, you see, we tried to discourage all that kind of thing. They would sometimes come up to peer if there was a banana anywhere. But as we discouraged any kind of contact, we didn't really have that much. There was one short period. It was before I realized we could make this a really long-term study. And it was so exciting to be able to go up to and groom a completely wild adult male chimp, David Greybeard. It was so exciting when a mother allowed her infant to come up and touch me. It was so incredibly moving when a juvenile allowed me to play with him. And I wouldn't have foregone those experiences, but in a way they were wrong, because it was dangerous to try and establish communication with them. It was dangerous to the objective collection of information.
You become too much of the story and start to change the chimp behavior by your presence and involvement.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it would be very easy to become part of the group. And then, for one, that would disturb the natural behavior more than we do by being there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And for another, it could be very dangerous because they do attack each other quite often for no very obvious reason sometimes.
You know, that reminds me, I think about 15 years into your research in the mid-70s, there was a war between two groups of chimps who you were studying, and one group was annihilated in that war. Did you know that that kind of fighting occurred?
No, we knew that the males of one social group, which we call a community, patrolled the boundaries of their territory. We knew that if they spied a stranger, they might chase, and if they caught up with that stranger, attack. We knew that they were sometimes extremely brutal to stranger females, but that there would be a sort of deliberate warfare where one by one the individuals of that small group were hounded down, brutally attacked, and left to die. That was a surprise, a bad surprise.
How were you able to watch it without getting hurt?
Because they weren't attempting to hurt us. They were completely concentrated on the victims. And because we have always made this conscious effort to remain outside their social life, they just ignored us. But it's very frightening to see chimpanzees so aggressive when you have 5 or 6 fully adult males attacking one victim. It's extremely brutal. And it teaches us that just as chimpanzees have very many of the characteristics that we see in ourselves of compassion and love and altruism, so too can they show a dark side of their nature.
Jane Goodall, recorded in 1993. Grizzly bears charge our next guest as Animal Week continues. This is Fresh Air. We've heard about some of the wildlife threatened in Africa. Let's get closer to home. A century ago, more than 1,000 grizzly bears lived in the continental United States. Today, it's estimated that 1% of that number, approximately 1,000 grizzlies, roam the western wilderness of the lower 48. Doug Peacock is an authority on the grizzly bear and has waged a campaign for more than 25 years to save the grizzly's habitat. In 1996, he told Fresh Air guest host Marty Moscowane about a scary encounter with a grizzly. He was sitting on a ridge in Glacier National Park, watching a mother and her cub in a meadow, when all of a sudden, the black grizzly appeared.
Well, actually, it was on a knife edge ridge in the wildest part of Glacier National Park, where people never go. There's no trails. It's not a very attractive place. It's buggy and brushy, not very scenic, but it's just full of grizzly bears. And this bear that I call a black grizzly really was my Moby Dick grizzly. He's an incredible bear, but a cantankerous one. And I was on the top of this ridge looking almost straight down, watching a mother with her yearling cub browse on huckleberries. It was late August, and that's what the bears eat up there. And after about 15 minutes, I was aware of some noise way down in the bottom of this little valley, a little mountain cirque. And you can hear grizzlies a lot of the time before you ever see them in country like that. And all of a sudden, I saw and recognized this black grizzly who, among this group of grizzlies that congregate, you know, loosely, they don't get together for a social occasion, but they get together and put up with one another because of the food. And so it's like a gathering of grizzlies where there may be, 20 or 30 grizzlies in an area of just a few square miles. And they form a sort of dominance hierarchy. And at the top of this hierarchy sat this black grizzly. And it's hard to sex adult grizzlies, but big black ones tend to be males. And there was no question in my mind that the black grizzly was the alpha male of this social congregation. And so I watched these three bears, unaware of each other, browse on huckleberries, moving up the side of a mountain. And it occurred to me that the black grizzly was closing on this mother and her yearling grizzly cub. And I didn't know what was going to happen. At the same time, I'm in the middle of no place. There's a winter storm blowing in, and my tent is on the top of a ridge about a mile away, and all of this is unfolding between me and my tent. Anyway, I looked down, and all of a sudden, I heard a roar and a rush, and I saw the black grizzly racing uphill. Bears, grizzly bears can run very, very fast, up to 41 miles per hour. That's a lot faster than any of our Olympic athletes, you know, by a factor of 15 to 17 miles per hour. And they can run up or downhill at amazing rates. And he ran right up towards this mother and her cub. And the mother naturally raced and headed this grizzly, ran across the ridge, not more than 100 feet in front of me, the bears unaware of my presence, and continued contouring around the side of a mountain. And the black grizzly was closing on this mother until the black grizzly was just inches behind the yearling club that looked like he was going to get killed. And at the last minute, the mother bear just spun effortlessly on her rear paws and turned around and met this black grizzly. And they roared and they locked jaws and they both rose to a standing position. And, you know, roars the likes of which I've only heard maybe three times in all nature just filled this mountain valley. And this went on for several minutes. And to make a long story short, all of a sudden the black grizzly, when it looked like he was really going to break the neck of this mother and this female grizzly, just turned his head off to the side. And that's a sign that he was done fighting.
Is that a sign that he believes he won?
No, it's just a sign that he's done fighting. And grizzlies do this to each other all the time. And once they turn, you know, turn their flank like that, turn their head away, neither grizzly will violate that. I don't know what to make of that, but that's just the way it is. And then slowly, the mother moved uphill, rejoined her cub, and the black grizzly stood there on the mountaintop with the sun, you know, disappearing behind the ridge between me and my tent.
And you wanted to get back to your tent.
It was going
to
snow that night. I didn't want to freeze out on the ridge, you know.
But you had this big grizzly bear that was in the way. How did you disguise yourself in order to try to pass by him?
Well, I had to make a decision that I'd had no other option. I had to get back up to my tent. This was sort of a dangerously cold night. I probably wouldn't have died, but I would have been miserable with about 6 inches of wet snow. And so I decided I had to go more or less face him down. And I didn't really, I don't know what I do when I'm in those situations. I've done it a number of times, but each time I just sort of let my instincts go. And this time I just remembered I happened to be filming. That's what I was doing in this country. I was not a biologist. I was making the last documentary film of what I thought were the last free-ranging grizzlies in the continental United States. So I had a garbage bag, you know, one in each hand, kind of brown and black, and black and brown grizzlies tend to be males, and I started walking towards this grizzly. And he's only 50 to 100 feet away, and he hadn't seen me yet. And when he looked at me, with me talking, I talk to bears. I don't think it's terribly important what I say. I never remember what I say, but I do talk to them. I never look at them. This is the way they behave around one another. And, you know, this bear saw me and looked straight at me. Grizzlies don't do this to one another because that's a direct confrontation. And his ears went back, and the ruff on his back stood up, not unlike a dog. And that means probably you're going to get charged when that happens. And this bear did take one great hop charge, I would call it, slammed his paws down and closed about half the distance to me. And that was a long time ago. But I think this all unfolded in the next 30 or 40 seconds. But I remember talking to the bear looking straight at me from no more than 25 feet away. And then suddenly, without making a sound, the grizzly turned his head smoothly and gracefully off to the side and just disappeared into the brush.
Well, even though you say it doesn't matter what you were saying to the bear, what were you saying to the bear?
Probably something like, hey, Black Grizzly, it's just me, good old Arapaho. You know, I used to call myself Arapaho then. And, hey, give me another chance. I'll make it up to you later. I remember thinking that that's probably what I said. But it's the tone of voice, like an animal trainer would talk to a horse, that's important.
So Jess, what does that tone sound like?
I think it's conciliatory. It's not loud, but it's loud enough to identify yourself as a human being because I wanted him to know, you know, what I was.
Well, once you got to the camp, the bear came back two more times.
Yeah.
It sounds like to...
No, that was quite a night. I did. I got to this little camp, which is nothing more than a clump of trees on the top of a mountain right at timberline, and it's steep. It's just a little knoll, like a pyramid on three sides, and I built a fire that night, and I never build a fire out there because I don't want to drive the bears away. The bears don't necessarily like campfire smoke. And but I did that night because I was I got to the top of that ridge and I found myself shaking uncontrollably, which you know hadn't happened to me at that time since Vietnam. And I started a little fire, and it was dark by then. And no more than an hour later, I could hear the brush crunching. Bears make a lot of noise, especially at night. And this grizzly was coming up the side of the hill to check me out. And I got a few plumes of bear grass burning. Actually, it doesn't burn very well at either. I got it burning with a bunch of sticks. Went off to the side with a little torch 10 feet from the fire, and I can actually see the bear's eyes and talk to it some more, and it went back down the mountain. Well, about 45 minutes later, I heard the bear coming up a different angle of the mountain doing the same thing, and this scene repeated itself until about 2 a.m. when everything got quiet, the bear left, and I fell asleep.
Sounds almost personal.
It was personal, I think. You know, you're never sure of these things, but 2 days later, that same grizzly found my stash of gear tied high in a tree, and this bag contained a, you know, like a tent, a sleeping bag, a dirty T-shirt, some other stuff. The bear didn't touch the tent or anything else, but it literally ate the sleeping bag and a dirty T-shirt, everything that that smelled of me, delivering a very personal message, which I took to heart, and I left the mountains the same day.
We're listening to grizzly bear expert Doug Peacock in conversation with Marty Moscowain. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's Animal Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to Marty Moscowain's 1996 interview with grizzly bear expert Doug Peacock.
You've been tracking and writing about and talking about bears for almost three decades. What got you first interested?
My first connection with grizzly bears was because I was a Green Beret medic in Vietnam, and I came back after the Tet Offensive like many other vets, completely out of sorts. And I wasn't any good around people, didn't want to be around people. The one place that I've always been comfortable all my life is the woods, the wilderness. And so I lived in the American West, and I followed the snow line up towards the Wind Rivers of Wyoming and eventually up into Yellowstone. And that's where I ran into grizzlies. I didn't know anything about grizzlies. I had a malaria attack, and I had to go back into an area that of Yellowstone, which I knew that had hot springs, and I was going to soak in the hot springs and sort of regain my health, you know, like the old spas. Mm. And one day I was soaking in a little hot creek in Yellowstone, and it was, you know, it's quite hot. It's like a little bathtub, and the water is probably 108 or 10. You know, it's hot enough so that you got to get in kind of slow. But I looked off to the side, crossed a little meadow, and there's a mother grizzly and two big yearling cubs. And I didn't know anything about mother grizzlies at that time, but except you're supposed to stay away from them, you know, avoid them. They're the most dangerous animal on the continent. So I was soaking in this little hot creek, and it was October. The wind was blowing. The mother grizzly and her cub were probably 150 feet away. They weren't looking at me. They hadn't seen me. But when they weren't looking, I decided I would make a dash for this tree. So I stood up and made a fullbacks rush for this tree. Well, the whirlpool-like effect of the hot water took all the blood away from my brain. I immediately blacked out. I hit the tree, smack, you know, head-on with my forehead, cut a huge gash in my forehead. The blood was running down in my eyes, but I was so terrified I managed to get up the tree anyway. And I got right up to the top of the tree, you know, right up in the uttermost branches. And it turns out it really wasn't much bigger than a Christmas tree, you know. It was sort of a stupid little tree, no more than 10 feet tall. And so I clung to the upper branches of this tree for about, for the next 40 minutes while the grizzly bear and her two cubs grazed in this meadow, coming sometimes as close as 20 or 30 feet away, but never looking at me, pretending they knew, of course, I was up there, but they never looked at me. And meantime, here I am. It's 40 degrees out. The wind is blowing. I'm bleeding. I'm naked. I'm blue with cold and perched on the top of this silly little tree like some species of, you know.
I'm sorry to laugh.
silly, you know, towhee or a sparrow of some kind. Anyway, those bears, they got my attention. That's where it began.
Well, do you feel a kind of kinship with grizzly bears?
I do. And in those days, it was really clear to me, in the safety of retrospect now, 30 years later, almost 30 years later, that those bears really saved my life. You know, they allowed me to you know, regather the elements of my own humanity. And for complicated reasons of gratitude and duty, you know, I felt it was my responsibility to do what I could to improve their plight on Earth. And, you know, curiously, 25, 30 years later, you know, I had sort of decided in those days that, you know, that my battleground, my war would be the war for the American wilderness. And today, some 25 years later, you know, that seems as solid now today as it does, as it did then.
Doug Peacock spoke with Fresh Air guest host Marty Moscowane in 1996. Peacock is the author of The Grizzly Years in Search of the American Wilderness. Our Animal Week series is produced by Kathy Wolf. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I may go out tomorrow if I can borrow a coat to wear. Dressed in the latest style with my sincere smile and my dancing bear. Outrageous, alarming, courageous, charming. Now who could think that a boy and a bear could be well accepted anywhere? Why, it's just amazing how fair people can be. Seen at the nicest places where well-fed faces all stop and stare. Making the grandest entrance are Simon Smith and his dancing bear. They'll love us, won't they? They feed us, don't they? To think that a boy and a bear could be well accepted just anywhere. Why, it's just amazing how fair people can be. Simon Smith and his amazing dancing band.